This week on The Assignment with me, Audie Cornish.
The push to have bigger families and more babies is part of a movement called pronatalism. They are freaking out about declining global fertility rates. And that is real. It's a phenomenon called birth dearth. What's behind this push to start a new baby boom? Who are the voices pushing for a more pro-family America? And what exactly does that mean?
Listen to The Assignment with me, Audie Cornish, streaming now on your favorite podcast app.
People who once fled El Salvador for the U.S. are going back.
Nuestro país que está super lindo, está maravilloso.
El Salvador is beautiful, they say, and safe. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. Today, what's driving that reverse migration? Also, the latest from Tehran, where people who can't evacuate are helping each other out.
In Thailand, a proposed casino is supposed to bring economic relief. Not everyone is thrilled.
Human trafficking for sex work always goes hand in hand with casinos.
Plus, German kids learn in school to ride bikes safely, but it's not a perfect system.
Some children don't get the tests. They fail. And some adults are still traumatized.
That's all ahead today on The World.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. Thanks for tuning in this Thursday, and a happy Juneteenth to you. We are now in the seventh day of fighting between Israel and Iran, with crossfire in both directions.
This morning, an Iranian missile hit the main hospital in southern Israel, causing extensive damage and injuries, but no reported loss of life. Israel, meanwhile, struck Iran's Arak heavy water reactor, its latest attack on Iran's sprawling nuclear program. It's not just missiles flying back and forth. The country's leaders are also exchanging angry rhetoric. Israel's defense minister, for example, said that Iran's supreme leader should not continue to exist. Ayatollah Ali Khamenei has warned that U.S. involvement in the fight will result in irreparable damage.
Meanwhile, the lives of ordinary Iranians have been upended in the past week. Residents of Tehran have been given warnings from the Israeli military and President Trump to evacuate the city. But not everyone can leave. The World's Shirin Jafari starts our show with stories from some of the people who are still in the Iranian capital.
It's nighttime, and Babak, a photographer in Tehran, is speaking to the camera on his phone. He, like many others, doesn't use his full name online because of security concerns. You're hearing my voice from the most dangerous place in the world, he says. Tehran is empty. Everyone has left. I've never seen the city like this. He says gas stations across town, which until recently were packed, have now three or four cars waiting in line. He asks his followers to share this video around so that those who have stayed in Tehran know that they are not alone. Let's keep in touch, he says. Since the start of its attacks on Iran last Friday, the Israeli military has issued evacuation orders for several parts of Tehran. The orders are posted on the military's social media account in Farsi. Often they come in the middle of the night. The Iranian government has also severely restricted access to the internet, so many won't be able to see them. This week, President Trump posted online that, quote, everyone should immediately evacuate Tehran. That sent panic across town. His message came around 3 in the morning local time. My father is a political prisoner, says Mahraveh Khandan in an emotional video she posted online. Can you explain to me how he can evacuate? Khandan's father, Reza, is a human rights activist, and her mother is a well-known lawyer. Khandan is out of the country, but for those still in Tehran, nights are spent like this, sheltering in place, the sound of explosions in the background. Apartment buildings in Tehran don't have bomb shelters. Shirin Rastagarpour, a translator, decided to stay. One problem is that we don't know which cities are safe, she tells me. Who knows if the place we go to is bombed as well. Meanwhile, Rastagarpour has set up a support group to help the elderly and sick who haven't been able to leave the city.
من هستم، خواهرم هست، دوستان نزدیک، آدمهایی که بهشون اعتماد دارم.
It's me, my sister, and a couple of friends who I trust. She says they go around Tehran and help them with groceries or any medications they might need. Rastegarpour says since she put out the call about helping those in need, she's received a lot of messages from Iranians who live abroad.
جراحی روده بزرگ کردند و زخمی که هست رو باید پرستار بتونه ببنده.
She describes helping an older man who had surgery recently. He needed care for his wounds.
عمده کاری که ما انجام میدیم همین هست که خریداشون انجام بدیم.
Sometimes we get calls from people who are scared and need someone to talk to, she says. We go to them and try to calm them down. These acts of solidarity and kindness are happening all over the country.
داریم با موتور میچرخیم، به هر کسی که میتونیم داریم کمک میکنیم.
This mechanic says he's been going up and down the highways leading out of Tehran to help anyone whose car has broken down.
دوستان تا پایان این شرایط فعلی انتظار پرداخت دست هیچ عزیزی نداریم.
This guy owns an appliance store and sells his items on installments. In this situation, he says, I don't expect anyone to be able to pay on time. That's totally okay.
توی سوپرمارکتی که دفعه اولی بودش که داشتم میرفتم پیشش، داشتم از اون مسیر رد میشدم.
In another video posted online, this man says he got a discount at a supermarket when the owner found out that he has been displaced from Tehran. According to Iran's health ministry, so far in Israel's military campaign, more than 200 people have been killed, most of them civilians. For now, people in Iran are holding their breath about what happens next. Amid all the horrors, they try to create small moments of distraction, as shown in this video of a man playing his violin in the streets of Tehran. The bright lights of airstrikes are visible in the sky above him. For the world, I'm Shirin Jafari.
Sir Geoffrey Palmer, who died last week at the age of 85, had a lifetime of accomplishments and accolades to his name. He was a pioneer botanist in the world of beer and whiskey, devising a way to speed up the malting process. Sir Geoff was also the first black professor in all of Scotland, later becoming chancellor at Harriet Watt University in Edinburgh. He used his position to call out Scotland's historic role in the transatlantic slave trade, but he had to overcome a lot of prejudice to get there. We asked Richard Williams, his colleague and friend at Harriet Watt University, to share why Sir Geoffrey Palmer is being remembered.
Well, first of all, his eminence as a brewing scientist, as you mentioned, for the work that he did that was published in the highest journals in Nature and had big consequences for the brewing sector across the world. So his research enabled new areas, for example, in Africa to produce crops that could be used in brewing and making beer. So on the scientific side, in both brewing and distilling, that's where he has incredible accolades and has been responsible for educating people in brewing and distilling for many years. And then there was the human side. He was ardent in his belief that it's through education that people's minds will change, and that is the pathway to conquer racism. So he actually stood out as being rather different in his approach.
Take us to Palmer's early life. I mean, I know he came to the UK from Jamaica as a child, post-World War II as part of what's known as the Windrush generation. Tell us about that wave of immigrants from the Caribbean and how being a part of it shaped Palmer's youth.
His mother had emigrated early, and he was left and looked after by his sisters and his family. And when he was about 14, he went across and joined his mother. And his family actually wrapped him in a newspaper to keep him warm on the ship. And he arrived in London in 1955, and he was aged 14 at that stage. And then he went on to school. And I think because he was a very good cricket player, not a game necessarily that's well known in USA, but he was a very good cricket player and people wanted him on their team. And he was able to go get a good education. And that fired him up then because he went on to study botany at Leicester University and then became a researcher before ending up at Harriet Watt to do his PhD in 1967 and then going on to be a world-leading researcher in brewing and distilling.
So, Richard, let's talk about Sir Jeff's legacy in the field of grains and malting. What do you know about those contributions?
Well, I'm not a grain scientist, but I think the essence of what he discovered was that in the early days, in the mid-60s, people thought that to understand how to get barley to malt faster involved looking at what was going on in the heart of the grain. And through his research, he found out that actually what was most important was actually looking at what was happening in the outer layers of the grain, in the pericarp and the testa region. And from that, after doing sort of research, he was able to show that if you stimulated and removed that part, you could increase the rate of malting.
Well, indeed, I read that he influenced the sourcing of grains for beer brewed in African countries, for example.
That's right. And particularly in Nigeria with sorghum, which grows very well in Nigeria. And it previously had been thought to be not suitable for brewing. But of course, by implementing the process of activating the grains in the way that he specified, it was possible to accelerate the malting process, which then meant that sorghum could be used in brewing. And indeed, a very large brewing sector has since developed across Africa, and particularly in Nigeria.
The position Sir Jeff held as a professor and his discoveries gave him ultimately agency to be an outspoken voice in Edinburgh for the UK's black community. What issues did he champion?
Basically, he championed that there is one humanity. Whatever anybody says, there is one humanity. We are each humans. We are each valued. We have our own culture. That was his mantra. And his other mantra was advocating that it was through education, discussion, and knowledge that people would come to understand each other better through education.
Well, he waded, interestingly, into the heated debates over statues and memorials to historic figures with links to the slave trade in 2020. He was against removing those monuments, and he explained his thinking in a 2020 interview with Euronews.
When we have two things, the system tend to do the easier of the two. And the easier of the two is to take a statue down. Because it's taken over 200 years to deal with racism. It's taken, you know, 2 days to deal with a statue.
How did that take go over in Scotland? Was there disagreement with his view?
There is disagreement in that area, but I think Jeff was absolutely ardent and sometimes a sole voice in that, particularly in the rest of the UK. But in Scotland, that view has grown to be a very strong view. And there are several examples now of statues where there were activist movements to take them down, but they haven't been taken down.
Richard, I wonder if you have one personal memory or snapshot of Sir Jeff that captures for you who he was.
Well, I think the most amazing and amusing thing is I went with Sir Jeff to the unveiling of his portrait. He was one of the 10 people from the Windrush generation who had a portrait undertaken as part of the Royal Gallery in Buckingham Palace. And we went to see the revealing of the portrait. And it was a very emotional day because in that portrait, it contains his picture, but in the background is images of the newspaper that he was wrapped in to come across on that boat.
Wow.
In 1955 to London. And I think we all looked at that and we thought, my goodness, what a journey he has undertaken and what a journey he has been on. And who could have guessed that's what life would have brought for him?
Richard Williams is principal and vice chancellor at Harriet Watt University and was a friend and colleague to Sir Geoffrey Palmer, who died last week at age 85.
Rwanda and the Democratic Republic of Congo are slated to sign a peace agreement next week to stop the fighting in eastern DRC between government forces and the M23 rebel group. M23 controls multiple cities and towns along DRC's border with Rwanda. Thousands of Rwandan soldiers are part of that occupation, though Rwanda has long denied involvement with M23.
The draft peace deal would initiate the removal of Rwandan troops from M23-held areas in the DRC. It also calls for the disarmament of non-state armed groups. The agreement comes after talks in Washington. The Trump administration agreed to help facilitate peace in the region in exchange for Western investment in mineral extraction there.
Critics say the actual agreement between the DRC and Rwanda does not differ significantly from previous failed attempts at brokering peace.
Americans are honoring Juneteenth today, an occasion to reflect on the legacy of slavery in the United States. Coming up, the story of one man enslaved in the North and his roots in West Africa. You're listening to The World.
I'm Tinku Ray, executive editor here at The World. While I may not be a familiar voice, I've been deeply committed to our work here at The World for years, helping to share the exceptional global journalism you know and love. Since our launch in 1996, The World has weathered many storms, and we remain committed to being your trusted source for human-centered international news, shared with integrity and care. But we are in unprecedented times, and never has the threat to public media been greater than right now because of the efforts to withdraw all federal funding. This puts greater pressure on our newsroom and our journalists. As an independent, non-profit newsroom, we aren't controlled by billionaire owners or corporations. We're powered by listeners like you. And right now, we need your help. Even if you've never given before, perhaps today is the day. We are in our spring fundraising drive, and a generous donor has offered a 2-to-1 match, tripling your impact between now and June 30th. That means if you donate $25, we receive $75. Your $100 equals to another $300. If you've given in the past, please consider renewing your gift or increasing your monthly contribution, if only by a small amount. Every gift, no matter how small, truly makes a difference. Please visit theworld.org/give to learn more and to make your donation now. That's theworld.org/give. On behalf of the entire team here at The World, thank you. You make our work possible.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Stories of American slavery are often rooted in the South, but New England is also implicated in that history. One of the first published accounts of slavery in the North was written by a man named Venture Smith, who was enslaved in Rhode Island. Last year, Connecticut Public Radio's Diane Orson met Smith's descendants to hear his story. Diane begins her report with Venture Smith's own words.
I was born at Dunkandara in Guinea, about the year 1729. My father's name was Sangam Furo, prince of the tribe of Dunkandara.
So begins the narrative of a boy named Brotir. As a child, he watched as his father was killed. Then he was kidnapped, marched hundreds of miles to the African coast, and taken on a ship.
I was bought on board by one Robertson Mumford, steward of said vessel, for 4 gallons of rum and a piece of calico.
He gave him the name Venture, because it was a good venture for him to purchase this young child. I'm Susie Ryan, and I'm a 9th-generation descendant of Venture Smith.
Most survivors of the voyage across the Atlantic were sold in Barbados, but Venture continued on to the U.S., not to the South, but to the North. He was taken to Rhode Island and grew up enslaved along coastal New England. He married, had a child, then was sold and brought to Stonington, Connecticut.
I was sold to a Thomas Stanton, and had to be separated from my wife and one daughter, who was about 1 month old.
A year later, Stanton bought Venture's wife and daughter, and there were more children. There were also violent conflicts with the Stanton family. Venture was sold again. He was determined to be reunited with his loved ones, so he spent years saving the money to buy his freedom. And at the age of 36, he succeeded, says Susie Ryan.
Despite everything that happened to him, he was determined to live his life as a free man. He actually stood his ground. And when a black person says, I'm going to stand my ground or stand for who I am, that feels like a threat to a lot of people.
My freedom is a privilege which nothing else can equal.
As a free man, he purchased 26 acres of land in Stonington, directly next door to the property where his family was still enslaved. We know this because decades later, he recounted his life story, and it was published in 1798, one of the earliest known eyewitness accounts of slavery in the United States. John Wood Sweet is an historian of early America at the University of North Carolina. He's writing a book about Venture Smith.
I think it's really important when you have a narrative like Venture Smith that challenges common narratives of American history, to be able to root him in an actual physical landscape to demonstrate that events that he describes happening did happen, that the people he discusses were the people who were there.
We're in Stonington at what's now the Barn Island Wildlife Management Area. There are trees and forest around us, but 200 years ago, this was the farm where Venture Smith was enslaved by Thomas Stanton. We walk along a centuries-old pathway to a clearing and see stone foundation walls for a small dwelling house. Researchers have confirmed that this was the home Venture Smith built while working to save the money to buy his family's freedom.
To me, this is a really meaningful site because this is a site that represents the way slavery tore families apart and how hard enslaved people and free people worked to reunite their families. The intimacy of this tract with the Stanton farm is a testament to his desire to be a good husband, to be a good father, to be connected to his family, even though legal ownership was separating them.
In 1774, Smith sold the land in Stonington and with the proceeds purchased land about 40 miles away on Haddam Neck on the Connecticut River. Over time, he was able to buy back his family's freedom. He became a busy entrepreneur, farming, logging, fishing, and trading along the river. His property grew to more than 100 acres. Venture Smith died in 1805, and he's buried at First Church Cemetery in East Haddam. Each year, his descendants meet there to honor him. Nearly 100 people attended last summer's gathering, about 30 of whom were descendants. Amina Merritt flew in from California.
The first time I came and I put my hand on the headstone and I fell to my knees and cried uncontrollably. I had never felt anything like that before.
Merritt discovered her family history through a letter from Dr. Carl Stofko. He's East Haddam's longtime town historian. I find Dr. Stofko in the crowd. He walks with me over to Venture Smith's grave and reads from the headstone.
Sacred to the memory of Venture Smith, an African, the son of a king. He was kidnapped and sold, but by his industry, he acquired money to purchase his freedom.
Corinne Henry Brady is a descendant from Rhode Island. She describes a trip she took to Africa.
We went to Ghana, where Venture was captured and enslaved and then brought to Newport. It was very emotional because I had some of my dad's ashes, and at one point we walked through the door of no return. Excuse me. And I was able to bring my father's ashes back to Africa. So it was very moving. Needless to say, it was a wonderful experience. It really helped me to understand who I was, who I am, and where I came from.
More and more people are learning about Venture Smith, in part because his narrative was published, but also because his descendants keep his story alive. Akia DeBarros-Gomes is a visiting scholar at Brown University's Center for the Study of Slavery and Justice. She says we should be careful with stories of Black men and women who may be perceived as unique or exceptional.
My mind always goes to how many more Venture Smiths would there have been had racism and slavery not been a factor in their daily lives. They are really important stories, but we need to be careful to make sure that we are not somehow saying that individuals like Venture Smith are different from the rest of the Black population.
Venture Smith shared his story, says his descendant Susie Ryan, and she hopes he inspires others to share theirs.
The history of enslaved people, it's out there. It's just not uncovered.
And history's waiting, she says, for those stories to be told. For The World, I'm Diane Orson.
Animals and how humans are dealing with them are making news in Vilnius, Lithuania. A brown bear spent a few days this week wandering the suburbs, becoming a social media celebrity.
The government wanted the bear gone and gave legal permission to kill the bear, even though brown bears are protected in Lithuania. That plan did not go over well. Even the Lithuanian Association of Hunters and Fishermen was shocked by it.
The hunter suggested instead the bear should be sedated and relocated. Ultimately, the bear took matters into her own, paws and found her own way back into the forest.
Next up, raccoons. The Guardian reports that the German city of Kassel is overrun with them. Raccoons were introduced into Germany almost a century ago. They're now classified as an invasive species because they threaten native wildlife.
Raccoons are omnivores and famously dexterous, which means they can prey on almost anything. Amphibians, bats in caves, birds in birdhouses. But there's some disagreement over how to cope with Kassel's raccoons.
One Kassel resident put it this way: we are the raccoon city. We love them, but we also hate them.
And that's your dose on this Thursday of news from the Animal Kingdom.
More global news is still ahead. You're listening to The World.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. For decades, El Salvador was a country people fled from, escaping gang violence, wars, natural disasters, and poverty. But that's been changing. Migration from El Salvador to the U.S. has declined sharply in recent years. And as the world's TBS Isaiah reports from the capital, San Salvador, an increasing number of migrants who left the country long ago are now returning home.
Even just a few years ago, downtown San Salvador was a place completely avoided by residents. A place where invisible lines would divide territories controlled by gangs.
Fíjate que antes era aterrador, la verdad. Ha mejorado bastante.
Walking here was terrifying, says Vanessa Carmina, close to the Cathedral Plaza. But today, there are tourists, young people, and families. The area has totally changed. At the center stands a new national library, six stories of glass and concrete, open 24 hours. Once known as one of the most dangerous countries in the world, El Salvador today is being rebranded by the government.
El clima de paz y seguridad que se vive en El Salvador lo ha convertido.
And by its people.
Lugar perfecto para donde se puede hacer turismo.
Hay it's a perfect lugares. Place for tourism, says Wendy Urbina. So beautiful and safe. President Nayib Bukele is conducting an aggressive crackdown on crime that has turned El Salvador into one of the safest countries in the Americas. There's also a new wave of public infrastructure and a push to attract tourism. That transformation is one reason Orsi Ticas decided to return after two decades living in California.
Nuestro país que está super lindo, está maravilloso, la seguridad es total.
Country is now beautiful and totally safe, says the 50-year-old from San Salvador. Chicas worked in the U.S. in hospitality and construction.
Estados Unidos es bien para ir a trabajar, pero es un trabajo fuerte y pesado.
The U.S. is good for working, he says, but the work is tough and not for everyone. He's one of a small number responding to a government program called Reverse Migration, which offers tax breaks and customs incentives for returnees. With two decades of U.S. savings, Chicas started a real estate business in El Salvador.
Tengo un par de negocios que me dan absolutamente la confianza de quedarme.
He says the business environment feels safe and stable. The reduced cost of living is what attracted another Salvadorian, José Vidal, to come back after 30 years of living in Los Angeles.
Una persona retirada en Estados Unidos, por grande que diga que es la cuota que le dan, no le ajusta para sobrevivir en Estados Unidos.
He says U.S. pensions aren't enough to live on there, but plenty to live comfortably in El Salvador. The number of returnees to El Salvador has been increasing, but remains small. Only about 15,000 Salvadorans have returned in 2024, according to the International Organization for Migration. And that includes both deported and voluntary cases. That's just about 1% of all Salvadorans living in the U.S. But a country where more migrants are returning than leaving is definitely a rare story in Latin America. And a 2022 survey, also by the IOM, found 60% of Salvadoran immigrants in the U.S. would like to return.
Pues de hecho, en mi entorno, conozco unas 10 personas que me
Orsi
están
Chica
que
says in his inner circle, he notes about 10 people planning to return this year. Still, many Salvadorans abroad remain in place.
En realidad, en este momento, yo no estoy considerando regresar a El Salvador.
Abel Núñez, a Salvadoran in Washington, D.C., says at this point he's lived more time in the U.S. than in El Salvador, and he considers the U.S. his country. Also, he worries about El Salvador becoming an increasingly authoritarian regime.
Creo que Bukele está tomando decisiones muy autoritarias.
A country where human rights are not respected, he says. But as an immigration activist, Núñez is hearing more and more about compatriots who feel unsafe in the U.S., where there are an estimated 700,000 undocumented immigrants from El Salvador.
La represión ha aumentado. La capacidad de vivir tranquilamente en el país está limitando.
He says Trump's immigration crackdown will end up pushing even more Salvadoran immigrants to return to their country. For the world, I'm Tibisa Isea, San Salvador.
Like many of their European neighbors, Germans are big on bicycles. Estimates suggest there are about as many bikes there as humans, about 85 million. Being able to ride a bike is considered such a crucial life skill that it is part of the curriculum in German schools. So we were a bit surprised to read a quote from the head of the German Road Safety Council in a recent news report that kids these days are having more trouble passing their cycling proficiency tests, which apparently are a thing. Katja Diehl is a writer and a self-described mobility activist in Hamburg, and we called her up to ask her why. Katja, are you seeing this, kids being not quite as good or able to bike as they used to be?
Yeah, it's a really interesting story here in Germany because it's nice that you are seeing us as a bicycle-friendly country, but we are also car-centric because we have many car manufacturers here. I also heard that only 45% of German kids are outside each day, which means they are just traveling from closed room to closed room, from home to school or to kindergarten. And that is, of course, something where they don't sit on bikes, where they don't learn how to ride a bike. If you look to Paris, for example, there is Anne Hidalgo, the mayor, who is doing a really great job to shape the city for the people who live there and not for the cars. And she has, and I think in fourth class, all of the people learn how to ride a bike. But I think you need also safety in regards of infrastructure. Where you have safe bike lanes in Paris, there are really tiny little bikers on their bikes because the families feel free to let them go.
Hmm. I want to get back to two things you mentioned here. First, instruction in schools for riding bikes. Doesn't that also happen in Germany? I was reading in like third and fourth grade, there are cycling components of the curriculum.
Here in Germany, you do it with the police. And you are, as a child, you are taught to be safe on your own. It's sometimes a bit, for me, like victim blaming, because we as the adults, we are driving the cars and we should be really secure that the smaller ones are safe on their bikes. Also, some children don't get the attest. They fail. And some adults are still traumatized. I think that should not be the way.
Okay, so this is more of a test on if you can ride safely on streets. It's not an instruction on actually how to get up and go.
It's more like learning the rules. It's very, very German.
So also you mentioned safety. I'm wondering what bike infrastructure looks like in Germany and how safe you see it as going out there on the road yourself or kids going out there. You're saying that's another barrier to kids biking.
Yeah, of course, because in Germany you have the rule if there is a bicyclist on the road, he has the right to stay out of the dooring zone, which is the parked zone of cars where there is a door coming out of the way. And then you have like 1.5 meter also when you want to overdrive, when you have to drive around someone on a bicycle. If you have children, it is 2 meters, but it's not possible in a city like Hamburg. And in Paris, you have many hundreds of school streets where they are banned. There are no cars anymore. And people come and the people come by foot or by cycle or by scooter. And in Hamburg, we have none of them. And I totally understand that parents are saying it's not safe for my child, so I drive them to school. It's a bit of a spiral. It's really not so easy to get out of the car if you feel unsecured.
You know, this is all curious to hear because I know that a couple of years ago, Germany adopted a big comprehensive plan to double the number of bikers by 2030. It's been spending hundreds of millions of euros a year to do that. That is a serious investment. Is that paying dividends? Are you seeing a change in bike infrastructure there?
I think we have a backlash. In Berlin, which is our capital, there is a very conservative movement right now, which is turning back also built safe bicycle ways, which is Kantstraße. People in Berlin will know that there are so many people on bikes because it feels safe. And now they decided to give it back to the cars. They decided to make 30-kilometer zones again back to 50-kilometer zones, which is more dangerous for cyclists. So I like the PR and the public relation, but paper is not worth if it's not on the streets.
Katja Diehl is a mobility activist in Hamburg, Germany.
Early this morning, 125-mile-per-hour winds lashed the coast of Mexico. Hurricane Eric made landfall in Oaxaca as a Category 3 storm, somehow managing to thread the needle between the busy resort areas of Acapulco and Puerto Escondido, landing instead over sparsely populated agricultural areas and fishing villages.
The National Hurricane Center says there could be serious fallout from the storm in coming days in the states of Oaxaca and Guerrero. Here's forecaster Robbie Berg.
One of the biggest hazards that will remain for probably another day or so is the heavy rainfall. Even though the storm is going to weaken, we expect that there's going to be continuous rain in some of those mountainous areas, and some places could see upwards of 16 inches of rain.
That heavy rain could also bring flooding and mudslides.
Schools in the area are closed today, and shelters are ready to receive people in the path of any flooding. Meanwhile, in Acapulco, today's storm brought back memories of Hurricane Otis, which hit the city 2 years ago. That storm rapidly intensified and caught residents off guard, killing at least 52 people. Adrian Acevedo Durantes works in tourism in Acapulco and lost two boats in Hurricane Otis, so he took precautions as Eric headed toward the city. With Otis, we never expected one of that magnitude to come, he said. And now with climate change, the water is warmer and the hurricanes are more powerful.
Hurricane Eric also intensified quickly. It doubled in strength in less than a day. That's becoming more common due to climate change, and it makes forecasting hurricanes harder. Hurricane Eric formed in the eastern Pacific, which is seeing a slightly more active than usual early hurricane season. That's according to Brian McDoldy, a hurricane researcher with the University of Miami.
We're about a month into its hurricane season. This is the fifth named storm, the second hurricane, and those two are about a month ahead of normal.
We'll be keeping our eye on Hurricane Eric as we head into the weekend.
Thailand's economy is not doing so great this year. The country's prime minister wants to give it a boost by approving a giant casino, one of the biggest in the region. There's a hitch, though. Gambling is illegal in Thailand, and Buddhists who live there have long opposed it. As we hear from the world's Patrick Nguyen, no one knows where the casino would even be located or who would be allowed in.
There's a saying in Thailand, 10 burglaries and you still have a house, but one night of gambling, you can lose everything.
We play differently than just playing for fun.
Nonarit Bisonyabut is a policy analyst with the Thailand Development Research Institute.
We play so that we can get rich. And this is the attitude of the Thai people.
At least enough people to make many worry. Is a big, flashy casino worth it? Thailand's parliament is gearing up to debate legalizing casinos. Corporations such as Las Vegas Sands and MGM want a piece of the action. They promise it'll deliver a big jolt to the economy. Thailand's ruling party is now saying, look, we've got ways to make all sides happy.
The nature of the entertainment complex is set up to serve people who have money.
Yeah, only people who have a lot of money. Here's the government's pitch. Any foreigner could waltz right in and gamble till they drop. Fine. But Thai people could only go to this casino if they can prove they're super rich using tax returns. One proposal says they'd have to show $1.5 million in the bank. That's equivalent to the average Thai person's salary after working for about 150 years.
There is like this logic to it.
Nathan Paul Southern is with the Eyewitness Project, a Southeast Asia-based organization that does security analysis. He's looked deep into how casinos in this region work.
The government is less likely to have an enormous amount of opposition if you can create enough distance between the local population and gambling addiction.
That opposition comes from nationalist, often conservative Buddhist. You might expect hardline nationalist to say, hey, our people can go anywhere a foreigner can go, and not just the millionaires. But in Southeast Asia, they're more apt to think, we have to protect our people from wickedness. So says Nonavit.
So you need to understand that Thai people are really addicted to gambling.
He means even without casinos. In the countryside, someone gets married, there's a funeral, any big gathering, someone might set up a game, illegally.
A wedding or some people dead in your village, they're playing gambling like the back of the truck. It's so easy to set up.
This isn't roulette. They're games native to Thailand. A card game called Boktang. It's like Baccarat, but faster. Or a game called Fish, Shrimp, Crab, with pictures of tigers and fish and crabs on the dice. Someone rolls, you bet on which animal shows up. That's quaint, but Nathan Paul Southern says when gigantic casinos pop up, things can quickly get very dark.
Crimes like wildlife trafficking, drug trafficking, human trafficking for sex work, which always goes hand in hand with casinos.
Southern investigates casinos in neighboring Myanmar, Cambodia, and Laos. Each of these countries bans their citizens from even walking in the door. But these rules are not well enforced, and they don't keep the vice at bay. The United Nations reports that the environs of these casinos are hubs of vice, places where you can buy illegal tiger bone wine or cheap meth, and there's lots and lots of money laundering. Nathan Paul Southern says Asian crime syndicates always embed themselves in and around the region's casinos. He likens it to Las Vegas, not the Disney-fied Vegas of today, but the early years.
The first few decades of that place was the mafia coming in and setting up casinos, because it is the cliche perfect business model for an organized crime syndicate.
If you want to wash money from drugs or scams, which generate tens of billions for Asian crime syndicates, you can't claim to have made it all from a car wash.
Casinos have always been the biggest gift for anyone looking to take criminally gained money and then give it a legitimate origin.
Those are the cons. How about the pros? Well, according to MGM, a Thai casino project could generate $10 billion a year. The Thai government says it'll create jobs, building the complex, then housekeepers, cooks, maintenance, managers. The Thai parliament still has to debate where it would go and how they can make sure almost all the Thai people inside are dealing cards, not playing them. For The World, I'm Patrick Nguyen, Bangkok.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. There is a legend that long before Christopher Columbus set foot in the Americas, an African king reached this continent's shores in the 14th century. The tale of King Abu Bakari II is celebrated by many people, but it is tough to substantiate. Still, for teacher Valerie Tutson in Rhode Island, the idea that there might have been an African explorer was life-changing. She explained why for GBH's Stories from the State.
I worked hard to craft the opening to a story I could not wait to tell my students. I wanted to tell them the true story of Abu Bakari, an African king who had sailed across the sea in the 1300s, nearly 200 years before Christopher Columbus sailed to this side of the world, ushering in the era of colonialism that we are still reckoning with. I first found this story in a book called They Came Before Columbus by Ivan van Sertima, and when I was reading it, I couldn't put it down. I was captivated by his descriptions of the African civilizations, and I was inspired by the king's desire to put war aside and follow his dream to travel across the sea. I was nearly 30 years old, and I was angry because I'd never heard this story before. And I wanted to tell it. I wanted to tell it so that people would know that Black lives before the transatlantic slave trade and its impact on the world had warped our perception of what it has meant to be Black in the world. So I distilled all of that dense historical information and crafted an exciting adventure. And when my students rolled into the cafeteria-turned-drama class on that afternoon, I let it rip. I started with that rap, and I knew I had them. One of the kids started to beatbox underneath my words, and pretty soon we were all on the journey with Abu Bakri. As he dismissed his military advisors and called for the scholars from Timbuktu and then called for the boat builders to come, when that first fleet of boats were ready, we were there, and we watched them go down the river towards the sea. And when they didn't return, we understood why the king himself had to get on board that next fleet of ships and leave his kingdom behind to his family and his storyteller in pursuit of his dream. And when he arrived in Central America in 1311, we rejoiced that his dream had come true. Almost 200 years before Columbus in 1492. When the story was done, I felt good. There was a stillness in the room. And then I heard it. Nah, miss, that's not true. What do you mean? I looked over at the kid who had said this, and I was surprised. He was generally one of the most easygoing and supportive kids in the whole class. Nah, miss, he said. No African could have done anything like that. That's impossible. That story is a lie. And pretty soon, all of the rest of the kids were joining in. Yeah, miss, that's not true. That story's a lie. And the story magic was broken. I have to say that my first response to what they were doing was visceral. I was taken right back to my middle school days. In my small town, I was one of only a handful of Black kids in the entire school. And whenever we got to the part about Black history, it always started with slavery. And we would see those pictures of Africans, usually half naked, being crowded into the bottom of a ship. And my peers would snicker under their breaths, and I would hear them say things like ooga booga, ooga booga, or whatever it is a middle schooler imagines might be African. Because let's face it, we were all learning that they were primitive. Isn't that right? But even then, I knew in my bones that there was more to that. I just didn't know what it was. My mother was always trying to bring my brother and me books about Black history. And I remember Harriet Tubman and Frederick Douglass and Mary McLeod Bethune. But even those triumphant stories were always told in the context of slavery. But when I found that story of Abu Bakri, I found that more that I was looking for, and I wanted my students to have that. Here I was in a classroom with mostly Black and brown teenagers, and they couldn't even imagine that an African had sailed across the sea before Christopher Columbus. The young kid was Dominican, a mix of African and Spanish and European from the Caribbean, and he, like I, had somehow learned to denigrate Africa and her people. There's a saying in Zimbabwe that until the lion tells the story, the hunter always wins. There were mostly Black and brown kids at this school, but there was only one full-time Black teacher. All the others were white, and then those of us who were people of color were jobbed in to do extracurriculars, but we had a lot of leeway to bring in things that would benefit the students. I was young, I was Black, I was a teaching artist and a storyteller, and I had an opportunity. I looked at the faces of my students. This is a true story, and it is not the only one. Long before the African slave trade, there were African scholars, there were African doctors, there were African artisans and craftspeople. There still are. And we are going to learn and share their stories. We spent the whole semester studying ancient African civilizations, and we made a play. That young man was an African king, and at his side was a beautiful Black young woman as his queen, dressed in African garb. Now, that young man, he graduated high school. went to college, finished college, lived in Africa. And when he came back, he went back and got a master's in education. A few years ago, he was an acting administrator at the very school where he and I had met. Recently, he took a full-time administrative position at a school in the city where we both live. I know because I follow him on Facebook. And as I follow his adventures, I can't help but remember Abu Bakri and the journey he took centuries ago in pursuit of his dream. And I'm reminded again of how that story impacted my life's work.
Valerie Tutson shared her story for Stories from the Stage, produced by our colleagues at World TV. That is where we leave you on this Juneteenth holiday.
The World is produced by GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio in Boston and from the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. Thank you for listening.
The World is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people. From the Carnegie Corporation of New York, working to reduce political polarization through philanthropic support for education, democracy, and peace. More information at carnegie.org. By the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. macfound.org. By the PRX Ambassador Council, whose members include Betsy Atwater in memory of Paul Atwater Connolly, Helen and Russell Pine, the Sarlo Family Foundation, and the Patchwork Collective. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX.